right, morning, everybody. It's just a few minutes before we're supposed to officially start, and there's still tons of people streaming in. But I see that there's people hanging out back there, and I think there's some free spots up here. If you've got a seat open next to you, can you raise your hand? No? All right. It's too far to walk, I guess. All right, well, I'll just wait another minute and hope that I get at least three or four more people. You can put the music back on. That was a good mood setter. Yeah, it was. Yeah, that's great. So.
I've got you under my skin. I've got you deep in the heart of me. So deep in my heart that you're really a part of me. I've got you under my skin. I tried so not to give in. I said to myself, this affair.
Okay, it's about 9 o'clock. And I guess everybody's here that's going to be here. Good morning, everybody. Good morning, everybody. Yeah, there we go. How late were you up last night, just out of curiosity? Anybody up past one? I know there's one person in here. How about two? Three? Anybody past three? Anybody? All right, that's pretty good. So I guess everybody's pretty, I guess if past three is, you're not making a 9 o'clock session probably. But welcome to Windows Azure Overview or Introduction to Windows Azure. My name is Mark Rusinovich. I work in the Windows Azure group at Microsoft. I joined Microsoft in 2006. Some of you probably know a little bit about my history. I joined the Windows division and stayed there through the tail end of Vista, then Windows 7 and the beginning of Windows 8 planning. And then I saw the light, the cloud was the future, and we're going through a major, major disruption, the third in the, I think, the industry's history, going from mainframe to client server to now cloud and mobile. And this was an awesome time to jump in. I made the switch about 2.5 years ago into the cloud because it's so early that really the definition of cloud, I mean, when I started 2.5 years ago, nobody even knew what cloud was. People were using the word, and I think now people are starting to get a general sense of what cloud really is. And the opportunity here to define the platform and what the cloud is all about is, I liken to the people that worked on the original version of Windows and delivered Windows 3.0 and started that whole PC revolution. And I'm in this position now in the Azure group to do the same thing, but for the cloud, Microsoft Cloud Platform. And I guess I need to switch so you can see the deck, although I don't know how to switch the machine. So the button doesn't seem to be doing anything. Oh, maybe I need to do this. Something happened. How about this one? There we go. All right. I can figure out switchers. So this is a marketing kind of slide, obviously. And it kind of looks like a Match.com profile, the words you'd find on one of those. But this is Windows Azure. We really do consider it a flexible solution because, as you'll see, it supports the notion of cloud and working any way you want to with the components, with the services, with the software that we've got up in the cloud for you to put them together in the way that your solution needs them to fit together. It's open, and you'll see the examples of openness in the sense that we have embraced open standards. We've embraced other platforms besides Microsoft's own platforms, and in some cases, setting precedents for Microsoft, as you'll see. And we also really like to consider it solid, meaning that we are committed to making this platform ultra-reliable, ultra-available, and ultra-scalable so that you can bank your business on the platform. And as part of what we're talking about with making it something that is solid. We know that you've got your businesses all over the world. You've got your customers all over the world. I know a lot of you are probably from Europe or outside the United States. We've got a global presence with Windows Azure, and we're committed to expanding this global presence. This map right here, it's kind of hard to distinguish the differences in the dots, but the solid circles, like if you see over here, right here and there, those are what we call regions. Those are areas where we've got data center presences for compute hosting. And then the lighter colored circles are where we've got CDN point of presence so that you can push your static content out close to your customers. If you count the number of solid dots there, we've got a total of 8 of them. We've got 4 regions in the US, north, south, east, and west, and then we've got 2 in Asia and 2 in Europe. And this is following a pattern that we are intent on continuing, which is to have at least 2 data center regions in each geo area so that we can do backup and disaster recovery across those regions. And we do this automatically for you in the case of storage, as you'll see in a second. I want to quickly show you a little video of inside of one of our data centers. And it just gives you an idea of the scale that we're operating at. Windows Azure is right now on the scale of roughly 100 thousands, in the hundreds of thousands of servers, and we're adding literally thousands of servers every day. It's a completely lights-out operation that we've got in the data center, so when you go and provision compute or storage in Windows Azure, really you're just pushing through a completely automated provisioning stack down to servers that are sitting in a data center. We bring in these containers, we wire them up with water and air conditioning and power, and get them going. And you can see that we hire only very strong people to work in our data center setups. But that gives you an idea of the kind of scale. We've got, like I said, 8 regions today, and we're building right now. It takes 2 to 3 years to build out a new region with getting the sites, construction permits, setting up the data center, constructing it, and then bringing in servers. So we've got lots of those in flight, and you'll see them start to roll out next year. One of the benefits of cloud, and this is a definition of cloud, is that it's on demand, it's scalable, it's elastic, and it's self-service. And so Windows Azure fits all of those characteristics, meaning that you pay only for what you use. This is one of the huge benefits of cloud, is that you get the capacity when you need the capacity. And there's a great example right here at the SharePoint conference. If you go to the hands-on labs to work with Windows Azure virtual machines, we've set up the labs and we've provisioned, I think, on the order of thousands of servers, literally virtual machines onto thousands of servers in Windows Azure data centers to support the labs this week. And at the end of the week, we'll shut it all down. So we've really, as far as internal payment, we actually do internal payments at Microsoft. So SharePoint guys are paying the Azure guys to provision these virtual machines just for this week that they're using them, and then shut them down, and their bill stops when they stop, shut those down. So that's one of the awesome benefits. And you'll see me show examples of how we've got elasticity across all of our services as we go. Another aspect of cloud that we believe in is focusing on your apps, not the infrastructure. This is a different approach than what other cloud vendors have started with, or that you might run into, where they just purely host virtual machines and let you take it from there. That's great. You're leveraging somebody else's data center infrastructure and expertise in setting up networks and putting in servers, but you still have all of the overhead of worrying about getting that application into those virtual machines, patching it, updating it, putting in middleware services that your application depends on. Whereas what we want to do is deliver a higher level platform that lets you focus on just the application components, and we deliver the rest of the infrastructure, including the middleware. You'll also see me show examples of that throughout this session. Now I've got a little over an hour here to go through all of the things that we've got in Windows Azure, and each one of these sections that I touch on literally could be a whole presentation or multiple presentations on their own. So I'm just going to make big flybys, each of these, and just give you a flavor for what each of these capabilities consist of. And I'll start with the compute side of things. And one of the most familiar kinds of compute that people in the room probably have, and that's websites. So if you want to deploy a website into Windows Azure, we've got a website capability that we introduced last summer. And as far as openness with the websites, you can deploy in ASP.NET. We also support Node.js. You can deploy Node.js applications. Anybody doing Node.js, out of curiosity? I'll pretend I saw a hand go up. That's good. And we've got support for PHP as well. You can deploy literally in seconds, and I'm going to show you this in a few seconds, through a multiple forms. So we've got TFS set up. So if you've got a shop that's built up on Visual Studio, Team Foundation, and you want to leverage that, we've got Team Foundation in the cloud. We've got Team Foundation support on-premise where you can push up into the websites using TFS deployment. We've got Git, which I'll show you, and we've got FTP support. And the offer starts for free and lets you scale up as you need to into a paid version only if your capacity and scale dictates it. So let's go take a look at websites. And I'm going to flip over to the management portal. This is the Windows Azure management portal. Out of curiosity, how many people have seen the Windows Azure management portal before today? That's good. That means that you were watching the keynote yesterday, probably, where it was shown. But here in here's the websites tab. But what I'm going to do is say new, and then go create a website here in the compute section. There's website. And we can do a quick create here and just give it a URL. Anybody want to pick a URL just to make it interesting? What? Monkeys. Let's see if anybody's picked monkeys. And we're good with monkeys. Good. So it's going to be monkeys.azurewebsites.com. And let's see how long it takes to make this thing. Creating, creating, creating. And bam, we've got a website set up. Now, there's a few different ways to deploy code into that website. One of the ways that you can deploy code in the website is to go into Visual Studio. And I could go into Visual Studio, create a website, app, new project, create a MVC web, you know, web app here. And once I've created this thing, I literally can go download the provisioning, the information, the publish profile right here, and then put that into Visual Studio, and then I can right-click in the Visual Studio project and say publish, and it will take it from there, deploying it right up into Windows Azure. I thought it'd be more interesting, though, to show you an alternate form of publishing in Windows Azure just to highlight the fact that we are open. If you look at this different ways, like I mentioned TFS, Git, and then the publishing profile for Visual Studio, let's do Git publishing for this thing. So if we click on Git publishing, this is going to set up a Git repository that's connected to the website. And once that's set up, we can publish right from my laptop here up using that Git repository. And so let's go ahead and do that. I'm going to create a little web page here just to show you my awesome web programming skills. So let's call it website. Oh, let's call it monkeys, the directory. And let's say notepad default. .chtml, and here's here we go, HTML, and HTML, and then we can say body, and I can say hello SharePoint 2012, and it's pretty impressive, I know, and then I can say git init, git add, and git commit, and let's call this initial check-in. And at this point, we're ready to push this up to Azure. We've got the connection string right here. So let's do that. And then git push Azure master, which is what I just copied from right here, git push Azure master. So the instructions are all right there. And what this is doing now is connecting up to Windows Azure. I need to enter the website, the password that I'd set up. And then we're pushed up. And let's go and click on the monkey's website and see what's going on over the monkey's website. Go to dashboard, and then the URL is right here. And then there's hello SharePoint 2012. And I can easily make a change to it and push up that change. And the complete publishing history is reflected right here in deployments, no matter which way you deploy. You can see that I deployed through Git. You can actually wire this up to GitHub as well and push from your laptop or your development machine into GitHub and then have that deploy into Windows Azure. And the nice thing about this, too, in the development history view is that we give you the ability to roll forward or back to any particular deployment. So if I deployed a change and I wanted to roll back to the previous one, I just come into here into the portal and I can select this and say, deploy this version back here. So that's a quick look at the website. Now, the dashboard here, this dashboard view is something you'll see for basically all of our resources, which shows you monitoring information. So we can see the network traffic and the HTTP requests that we had on that on that website. We can go to the monitor tab, and this will show us some more detail. And we'll see how many requests I've served. So see a total of 17 requests. I'm guessing somebody in the audience has hit that website, because I didn't do it more than once. And we can see the data in and out as well. Now, one of the aspects of what we just saw is that we're using what are called shared websites. So up in Windows Azure, literally built as a Windows Azure platform as a service application, we have this website's infrastructure. It's actually running in all of our data centers, all our regions. And when you push a website into like US West, you're going to the website deployment, application deployment there, and it's pushing your website onto into a virtual machine where your site is sitting there alongside other people's websites. And that's why we call it shared. You're sitting there, it's a multi-tenant virtual machine. We have security isolation. We also have resource isolation between the websites, so nobody else can mess with you. But if you want more capacity, you can actually create more instances of the shared, and then we'll put you across different virtual machines and then load balance across them. So we can go to scale. And that's as easy as saying that you want more shared instances and dialing that up. And then I could say save, and that's going to scale me up to 2 shared instances at that point. So running 2 copies of my website on 2 different virtual machines potentially at the same time if I do have the traffic that's activating those websites. If we want something more, though, we can switch to reserved. And this is where you start paying money. And reserved is you're getting a full virtual machine's worth of compute and memory dedicated to you. And the reserved instance also means that you're not in that virtual machine with anybody else's code or data, which might be important to you. So I can say reserved here, and I pick my virtual machine size. I can see small, medium, and large, 4 cores and 7 gig of memory. I can also select a number of instances of the virtual machines, and now my website's going to be more responsive because it's not like I'm being activated, deactivated, along with other people's websites on that host, that multi-tenant shared deployment, but actually I've got my website sitting there in the VM. When I say save now, it's going to scale me out, and you'll see in a second here that scale out operation literally takes just a few seconds, and now I'll be sitting inside of 2 virtual machines with my website to myself. The nice thing too about this is that when you do a reserved instance, you can host multiple websites, multiple applications in those virtual machines as well. So that's another benefit of going with this reserve model. As far as the cost, so once you scale up to the shared, I think the free thing gets you 100,000 requests a day. So you can see I'm pretty far away from that with just 17. But if I wanted, if we had a bigger audience, then I might want to scale up to something bigger. And I could do that, again, on demand. So if I've got an event or something, I can scale up. After the event, scale back down into the free tier. It's as easy as that. The other thing about, before I just move on here, is let's say you don't want monkeys.azurewebsites.net as your URL. Once you go into the dedicated, or reserved, sorry, the reserved or shared, the reserved, sorry, tier, you get the ability to map a C name or an A name now to that website so that you can bring your own URL, even URLs that don't have www in front of them as well. So this is really a place for you to set up a business endpoint as well, not just a place to toy around with Git like I've been doing. So that's one slice, one kind of entry point into the compute model of Windows Azure, just simple websites. Now, even that might be a little much for people that are building client cloud kind of applications, mobile applications, where you don't want to go into the business of setting up an ASP.NET website, configuring databases, writing all the code to update tables in those databases. We've made it extremely simple to write a backend for mobile applications that handle things like push notifications, like database updates of a NoSQL type variety and a SQL type variety, and to be able to augment the cloud operations with snippets of JavaScript. That where you can add your own business logic to what's going on up in the cloud. And that's what we call mobile services. Right now, mobile services really, of course, the first class target for mobile services is Windows 8 applications, but we also have support for Windows Phone. We also have support for a lot of iOS features. And we're bringing out, of course, support for Android as well in the near future. I think we're announcing something next week or something. But we're literally adding functionality and features to all of the services. Here's a great example, which we're just consistently adding richer and richer support. Another aspect of the mobile services is that we also handle identity management for you, too. So you can integrate with Facebook, Google, Gmail, live accounts as well. And that identity management allows you to authenticate particular users to your mobile applications. You can also authenticate particular devices to your mobile applications. It's all made very simple. And let's go take a quick look at mobile services. And what I'm going to do to demonstrate this is just download the sample script. Now, what do you want to call our mobile service? I know it's very exciting to name these things, isn't it? What? Nobody wants to name it? Nameless? I don't think of bananas. That's a good one. Bananas. Let's see if anybody's taken. We're getting lucky here. So we want to create a new SQL database instance. I'm going to talk more about databases a little bit later, but this is going to basically do all of the magic of database setup for us. Let's create a server here. Create a new server. And it's going to ask us for a login name, and I'm going to choose. Actually, I'll just choose my name. And then it's going to ask for a password. And fortunately, I only ever use one password, so it's easy to remember. And there I go. Now, how long is it going to take to create this thing? And ready. Here we go. Almost there. Excitement's building. Tension's palpable. All right, no, it's going to take another 10 minutes. No, I'm just kidding. It should be done just about in a few seconds. This is the longest I've seen it take, actually, which is appropriate given that it's a demo. And maybe it's a portal problem. Let's refresh, see if that's true. Dreamweaver has been causing a lot of problems this week. Right here. And see, yeah, it must have been just a refresh problem. So Dreamweaver again. Damn. All right, so I'm going to just show you how easy it is to get started here. One of the, you can see across this, we've got a dashboard, we've got a data tab, a push tab, identity, configuration, scale, and also logs. Now, I'm going to choose this Windows Store platform for Windows 8. And to get started, let's just go ahead and download the sample app. First, it's going to ask us to create a to-do item table, and basically what this is showing us is how easy it is to create a to-do item application that you connect to from mobile devices. So it's going to create a to-do item table, and then we can also at the same time download the sample application, and there it is, bananas. And I'll just copy it into here, and then launch it. And let's go ahead and launch this thing and see what happens. It's going to launch a little Windows 8 store app, and it's going to then allow us to put in to-do items in the application interface. So let's just say I need to eat my banana and save that. And now that's just been pushed up into that table in Azure. Let's go take a look. Now, what's happening on this side of things, if I go to data, there's my to-do item list, my table, and we're going to see eat my bananas in there. And it's no SQL, and you'll see that if we went and took a look at the code, it's basically just dropping in a few fields. JSON, basically, it's going to be pushing up in there. And now I've just created a little app, and what I can do from that point on is add authentication front end. I can also add the ability, like I mentioned, to augment operations on that table with little snippets of JavaScript. So I can augment, update, delete, read operations. You can see that that's the JavaScript that's going to execute that request execute command right there is going to do the insertion. And so I can put in business logic either before or after that to validate the input parameters, to do other things, call other functions. So this is how easy it is to create a backend for a mobile application using mobile services, a relatively straightforward thing, process. I also mentioned that we've got the ability to scale this thing out. The mobile services are actually built on the websites feature. So what you're doing here is those actually represent websites, the same kind that we just created, except now another service is creating them on our behalf and then dropping the JavaScript snippets that we might specify here into those websites. So we've got some of the same capability to scale as we do for websites, naturally, because they're built on the same foundation, including the reserved instances if you want to, and you get a spending limit, as well as the spending limit warning, but as well as being able to pick the virtual machines that we want to host that. So if we have a very busy mobile backend, we can scale it out into full virtual machines if we'd like. Now the next topic, this is really where Azure got its start. It's something called cloud services. And if Azure started out with a reputation of being platform as a service, really focused on platform as a service, completely ignoring infrastructure as a service. Now, what's the difference between infrastructure as a service and platform as a service? Infrastructure as a service is that kind of virtual machine hosting that I mentioned earlier, where you just deploy raw virtual machines onto somebody else's data center, and you take it from there. Platform as a service, somebody else might provides a hosting environment, which may or may not be a virtual machine-based hosting environment. Those websites we looked at, that is a form of platform as a service. Even the mobile apps where you can execute JavaScript code, that is a form of platform as a service. Really, at that point, the cloud provider or the hoster is taking care of all of the infrastructure all the way up to the edge of your application, the frameworks, the runtimes, the patching of the operating system. But cloud services that we started with was virtual machine-based platform as a service. And it was targeted initially at ASP.NET type applications with a very restricted programming model, partial trust ASP.NET. What we found, though, over time is that people had trouble migrating their existing code up into Windows Azure's platform as a service because of the limitations around partial trust, the fact that lots of existing code needs admin rights, might have setup programs to run to install DLLs, and assemblies, and other components that your application might want to use. And so we relaxed the model over time to really just say, okay, fine, you want it, you got it, it's your virtual machine. What we'll take care of, though, is patching the virtual machine, as well as letting you push the application package to us, and we'll do orchestrated deployment of that application across your virtual machines. We'll also do the configuration of networking across tiers of your application, so you can divide your application into tiers, and then scale each of those independently with virtual machines. And what I'm going to show is a very quick demonstration of building a little application that is a two-tier application. It's got a front end that we call a web role and a back end that we call a worker role. It also uses Windows Azure Storage as part of the communications mechanism, the data transfer between the front end and the back end, or the middle tier. And it really will, you'll see, it'll just take me a few minutes and a few lines of code to build up a loosely coupled cloud scale type application where I literally can scale it out on demand using the sliders that you just saw or using Visual Studio to push out a scaled out application that is tolerant to failures, as I'll talk about in a minute, that has automatically load balanced, as I'll talk about in a minute, and that is automatically resilient to interruptions in the network connection between the two tiers. I call this application Branding Police. And I call it Branding Police because I had this idea. There's how many people work at companies where you've got a marketing department that gets really annoyed when you don't use the company label things the right way? You know, it's not decorated the right way. You didn't include the copyright symbol or the trademark or whatever. Well, when we started in Windows Azure, the marketing people really, every time we had a conference like this, they would demand to see our decks, and then they would go through them and say, do you have the word Windows in front of Azure everywhere in the deck? Because it's not Azure, because that's just a color. It's Windows Azure, which is an awesome cloud platform, and we want people to know that. So they would spend all this time and energy going through everybody's decks and fixing up all the references to Azure, because nobody got it right. And so I thought, you know what? I see a great money-making opportunity here. If I ever decide to leave Microsoft, I can make an application that will just scan PowerPoint decks looking for branding violations. And then every right before a presentation conference like this, everybody can upload their decks. It'll flag the branding violations. You can fix them up, and I'll make a ton of money. But then the marketing department stopped caring, I think. I don't know. The last time they checked my deck for branding violations was a long time ago. And I think they just gave up because everybody says Azure now. How many people say Windows Azure versus Azure? When you said, I'm going to go see that talk this morning, did you say I'm going to go see that Windows Azure talk or I'm going to go see that Azure talk? See, you know what I mean. All right, so I'm not going to make that money. I'm holding off my retirement from Microsoft for a little bit longer. But I wanted to show you the app that I started working on. And it really is just three pieces of code that I had to write. And I'm going to show you these pieces of code and talk about what they do here in a second. But let's go fire up that app, and I'll show you just how easy it is to create one of these multi-tier apps. And I'm going to go to File, New Project, and I'm going to scroll down to Windows Azure Cloud Service, and I'll just call it Windows Azure 2 since it automatically picked that name. And we're going to make it an MVC, the coolest kind of MVC app, with a worker role middle tier. So I've just picked my two tiers. I've said that I want a web role. And what web role means is that it's configured to automatically accept MVC or ASP.NET website package and deploy it. And so it's automatically configured. It will configure IIS and set it up, and I can actually do virtual directories and multiple sites in this thing if I wanted to. What we're doing is pretty simple, though. And what we're going to do is replace some pieces of the auto-generated code with those three text files that you just saw. And then we're going to actually see if this site works. And I'm going to show you something that's also part of our platform as a service, which is something called the Development Fabric. OK, so here we've got our project. We've got the web role up here. We've got the worker role down here. And then we've got the Windows Azure project, which here is where I'm going to do configuration for those two roles. The first thing I need to do is go into the views and replace the index with my little indexes. This is a stock index. And I've got the new index over here. And all this says is, welcome to the branding police. Upload a file. And then it's going to execute the analyze method. And the analyze method is sitting in the home controller here. So I need to go over to home controller, paste that in. And let's take a quick look at what this does. Analyze is going to say if there's a valid file name. It's going to go connect using a data connection string to cloud storage. Like I mentioned, it's going to use the Windows Azure Cloud Storage to do this communication. It's going to create a folder in there called documents. We call those containers. It's going to set a permission to let public access to it. And then it's going to upload that file that I specify into that blob in Windows Azure Storage. Then it's going to create a report file and drop in Windows Azure Storage and just put in the text, press working on blah, press to the, you know, press refresh. So please refresh. This is a very simple app. You know, what I should do is have it go off and do the work and then automatically refresh and show you the results. I'm just going to force you to press F5 to see the results. And what it's going to do is send a message, a queue message. And Windows Azure queues, very simple queuing infrastructure that's built on top of Windows Azure Storage, to send a message to the middle tier, who the middle tier is going to be sitting there waiting on that queue. So let's go take a look at that middle tier real quick. Here's the worker role, and I've got my worker role code I'm going to paste in. And what this does, it sits waiting on the queue, and when there's a message, it's going to get a reference to that report.txt, put in there currently processed by, it's going to say what instance it is, so each virtual machine gets its own instance ID, and this allows me to, in some more of the elaborate demos that I do, to go kill the one that's working on it, so you can see how this application, as simple as it is tolerant to the middle tier VM that's working on it dying, and then having another VM pick up the work automatically and transparently. So that's why I have that spit out there. And then it's going to call this thing down here, which is really, this is just going to use an OpenXML document parser to go and look for certain branding violations. So I'm almost ready to run this thing. I need to add that document parser assembly. It's open doc, open XML. And open XML, document parser to the project. And I don't know what happened to the network. And there it is. So I say install. And I've just installed that package. And I need to add one more reference. To do file IO, I need to add the Windows base. And so that's it. One last thing, that data connection string to connect to storage. What I'm going to do is first run this in what we call the development fabric, which is a one-box way to test applications like this, even if they're multi-tier, which I think is a really powerful feature of the platform. So I'm going to add that data connection string so that when the app tries to read it to connect to storage, a storage account, it's going to connect to the Windows Azure Storage Emulator, which is part of the development fabric. So that's right here, Storage Emulator. Come down here and press OK. Let me copy this string here. And I need to go and do that for the worker role as well, so they can talk to each other. Make it a connection string and say Development Storage Emulator. And now we're done. I'm going to press Run, and we're going to see this application fire up. Let me do one thing, which is really kind of cool. Once this thing is up, we're going to see the web page open, and it's going to prompt us to upload a doc. What I'm going to do to highlight the power of the development fabric is set a breakpoint right here when the worker tier gets a message from the queue, and I'm going to set a breakpoint in the home controller right before it drops the message in the queue, and you'll see Visual Studio break into it. Where's my website here? So I can say browse. I'm going to pick a deck that has a bunch of violations in it, and then press analyze. And what we're going to do is hit that breakpoint right here. And that's hitting that breakpoint when it's just about to drop the message in the queue. So if I press F5, the message is going to get dropped in the storage emulator queue, and that middle tier is going to pick it up at that point, and I'm going to hit the breakpoint in the worker role. And boom, this is the worker role. I press F5, and now it's saying, please refresh, and then it prints out the branding violations right there. This highlights the use of Windows Azure Storage, and there's many tools that let you look at Windows Azure Storage. I'm using one called Cloud Explorer, like Clumsy Leaf software, and I can see right here is the document that app is showing us. If I open it up, there's what it's showing us in the web page. It's dropped it into a blob here in a folder called Documents, like we saw. And now the storage, Windows Azure Storage, which this also touches on in the context of cloud services, Windows Azure Storage supports blobs, which are just giant, arbitrary chunks of binary stuff. A great place to put text files, to put media as well. It supports tables, which are NoSQL column store tables. And we saw an example of NoSQL column storage tables usage in that mobile application, and it also supports the queues that I just showed you, a very simple kind of inter-process communication or inter-role communication queues. The benefits of this architecture that I just showed you, I can publish now that application up into Windows Azure. I can just say right-click and say publish, and that's going to zip up those files, hand them to the Windows Azure front end, and deploy them into a data center onto virtual machines that I've picked. I can specify the scale characteristics in a few ways. One way is to do it right in Visual Studio. Here, when I was messing with the configuration for the roles, like let's say I wanted two front ends, down here I can specify the instance count, as well as the virtual machine size, all the way up to extra large, which is 14 gig of RAM. And then I can right-click on this thing, on the solution, on the project. Well, I can say build. Where is it? Publish. Here. Publish. And what that's going to do is publish this up into Windows Azure. I've already done that, and we've got that application running up in Windows Azure here as one of the cloud services that I've got deployed. Cloud services. And here's the Branding Police application. And we get the same kind of monitoring dashboard up here that we saw for websites and mobile services. It's going to show us our percentage of CPU usage that's going on. Now, I haven't done anything with this deployed version of that application that I just built, but it's sitting out there running, and here's the site URL. This one is an old, I did it in ASP.MVC2, so it's got a different look to it, and I haven't pushed the new version up there, which I just updated yesterday. But you can see it's the exact same thing, and if I did this browse and deploy, we'd have that same experience. Now, these are virtual machines, and if I wanted to, I can go to instances and see what instances of those virtual machines. I've scaled this out to 2 instances each of the worker role and the web role. And we've got this 2 columns over here, update domain and fault domain. What this demonstrates is that orchestration that I talked about that's part of our platform as a service. When you push an application update up into these roles, what you don't want to have happening is all of those instances to go down at the same time. And then when a customer shows up, they basically get a 404, or you put up some page that says the site's undergoing maintenance. But rather, we do an orchestrated walk of those instances, taking down one, pushing the updated code or config, when that's back up and running, moving on to the next one. And that's what we call update domains there. So we will only take down one of those 2 front ends or middle tiers as we push this update. Over on the fault domain side, we also give you automatic high availability based on the hardware topology of our data center. So what we don't want to have happening is when you deploy these 2 worker roles, that they end up on the same physical server. And when that physical server dies, your whole application goes down. So we spread them across at least what we call 2 fault domains. A fault domain is a single point of failure in the data center. Right now, that's a server and a top-of-rack router, which is not redundant. So if a top-of-rack router fails, we lose connectivity to all the servers in that rack. So what we'll do is spread those instances across at least 2 racks. What I've just built and deployed is a highly available application that's tolerant to hardware failures in the data center, as well as to me pushing updates, even updates that cause an availability downtime for that instance being updated because of this automatic orchestration we've got. So that's just a touching on some of the capabilities of cloud services. There's a bunch more that I haven't had a chance to talk about, but it's time to move on to the next topic, which is, here's the load balancer. I mentioned automatically load balancing. And what we call that is that service healing. That's when a VM goes down on a particular server and is moved to another one, the load balancer automatically rewires to that new instance of the server. This just talks about that Branding Police applications architecture. One of the aspects of Windows Azure is that besides these foundational compute building blocks, we create a lot of middleware services that your applications can take advantage of that provide rich connectivity or identity management services or other database type functionality. And I'm going to start to touch on those now. The first one I'm going to talk about, virtual machines. Raw virtual machines. So we've been talking about running these cloud services in virtual machines. What I'm going to talk about now is what we've introduced just this summer, which is infrastructure as a service virtual machines. We've finally invented real virtual machines in Windows Azure. Now let me explain briefly the difference between this type of virtual machine and the other type of virtual machine, because it can get a little confusing. The virtual machines I was just showing you in the cloud service, those are our platform virtual machines, and they're designed for cloud-style applications. We consider a cloud-style application one to be stateless, because that's the easiest way to write code is to be stateless, to perform idempotent operations, and to be loosely connected across your tiers. If you have any state that you want to persist, externalize it to some external storage service that provides highly durable, persistent storage, where people that are like Einstein have figured out how to do replication and failovers and scale outs and cross-geo replication as well, where you just focus on the code of your application, the communication pattern of your application. So those virtual machines we were using are stateless. And that means that if I go into those virtual machines, and I can RDP into them, just like any other virtual machine, I'm admin on those virtual machines. But if I create a file in the root directory of the operating system volume, like monkeys, I could come back 3 weeks from now and log into that same instance, instance zero of middle of front end, and that file might be gone. Why would it be gone? Because it's a stateless virtual machine, which means that the data that it's writing to its local disks are actually on servers, on the disks on the servers in the data center, and underneath that virtual machine. So if that server fails, you lose those disks. And your virtual machine gets reincarnated on another server, and it's from a base image, base OS with your app freshly layered on top of it, no recollection of what it did before in its previous life on that failed server. This type of virtual machine, however, is a persistent virtual machine. It's the kind that you know and love and think about when you think virtual machine, where if you wrote a file called monkeys to the root of the C drive, you come back 6 months later, you expect that file to still be there. And so why did we introduce the other one first and then this one? Well, platform as a service is where we see the future. This is the benefits of just worrying about your application and having the platform take care of the rest are extremely powerful, as you saw, with me just being able to create a multi-tier, highly available app just in a few minutes. With this, though, you get the ability to bring existing server applications, ones that aren't designed for that world, ones that do expect to write Mark or monkeys to the root of the C drive and expect it to be there. SQL Server is a great example. If SQL Server, you create a database on the data disk of the virtual machine, you expect 6 months later for that data to be there. If it's not, you've got a problem. So this allows you to bring in existing code. It allows allows operating systems besides Windows. Right now, our platform as a service is purely Windows-based. Here, you can see that we support Linux as well. And it supports virtual networking capabilities that are also tied into our platform as a service. But this is one place where we see, as migration happens from enterprise into cloud, enterprises want secure VPN tunnels into the cloud. They don't want to be going over the open internet. So what we did at the same time we released virtual machines this summer is released virtual networking support as well that allows VPN tunnels from through a bunch of different VPN devices up into Windows Azure so you're not going out over the insecure open internet. I'm going to just show you a quick demonstration of the virtual machine capability by going into the portal, going to virtual machine, and we're going to create a new one here. And what do you want to call this one? You guys have been very creative this morning, so. Banana. That's not very creative, but I'll go with it. And you can see, somebody already picked banana, sorry. Apple. No, I don't like that word. Koala. Yeah, this is testing my spelling skills. Koala. Is that right? Let's say we're good with koala. All right. And you can see that we have a whole bunch of images here that you can pick from, including Linux images. And we like Linux so much, it's apparently first on our list. Although I think we're going to probably change that soon. But yeah, so why don't we just go ahead and pick it, see, just to show them. And then I'm going to set a password. I get to pick the region that I want it to deploy in. Remember, I talked about the data center regions that you get to choose. We just go ahead and with the default of West. Whoops. And I accidentally deleted or dismissed the dialogue. Sorry about that. But I've got, fortunately, some virtual machines hanging around here, including, well, I don't have my Linux virtual machine. I've got some, there it is. I do have a Linux virtual machine here. This is one I created this morning. It's a Linux virtual machine running Ubuntu. And again, you get the full dashboard experience showing you the physical, the CPU usage, as well as network and disk I/O coming out of this virtual machine. It's got an endpoint, so if I put a website in there, I'd be able to hit it at this DNS address, which is a public address. Here's the public IP address we've mapped to it. And then we also have SSH or RDP details. If this was a Windows machine, we would have the ability to download an RDP file that if I just clicked on it, it would automatically connect to that virtual machine and let me log in. Because this is Linux, it's going to give me an SSH endpoint. And so I can simply say, drop that into any of my SSH clients. And now I'm logged in, or not. Okay. Maybe I give it a different username. It can't be a different password because I, like I said, I only have one. So. Yeah, let me. Oh, it is? Okay. That Linux case sensitivity gets me every time. There we go. And, you know, I can do top and or TPO. I can do TPO, but that doesn't work very well. Or I can do it twice, and that has the same result as you would expect from a solid Linux distribution. But I can do top, and then you can see, you know, this really awesome command, which it's not as good as ps list from sysinternals for Windows, but it's okay. So there we go. And speaking of other things we can do here, I mentioned load balanced endpoints and SSH endpoints. Here's the SSH endpoint, so I can just open up publicly the endpoints that I want exposed to the internet. Again, if I put other virtual machines in the same service with this one, in the same application with this one, then they can talk to each other internally without going over the internet. But to connect to it from the outside, of course, I've got to go through SSH here as well. And this is also what lets me do things like add load balanced endpoints. So I can, if I've got other virtual machines that I want to, that I've got in the same service with this, I can add other virtual machines to it and create a load balanced endpoint. I can give other names, like I could say HTTP, and then say I want it to be port 80. And if I want it load balanced, I can pick another machine here and have it be load balanced with. Also, over here in the Configure tab, this is what lets me pick the size. And you saw me choose a size in that wizard. I can adjust the size here. And what that will do is shut down this virtual machine, gracefully shut it down, and then restart it with a new size virtual machine, potentially even on a different server. But because this is a true virtual machine in this persistent sense, anything that I did there, if I created a file called monkeys, it would show up there again. All of that local data, you know, seemingly local data, is persisted. Under the hood, though, oh, and I talked about fault domains. We can take advantage of fault domains and update domains with this as well, so that we can make sure that we can do orchestrated updates in a way that doesn't cause downtime. We can spread multiple virtual machines of a particular tier across fault domains, across single points of failure in the data center. I will actually talk a lot more about availability sets, load balancing for virtual machines in my afternoon session. Sorry, I don't have time for questions here. I'll take them after. In my afternoon session on Windows Azure Infrastructure as a Service, Windows Azure Virtual Machines. But that gives you an idea that we've made those same capabilities that we introduced for PaaS available for IaaS as well. Now, what's going on underneath the hood? If these disks aren't really on the servers, where are they? Well, they're actually in Windows Azure Storage. And they're in Windows Azure Storage using standard VHD format, which allows us to, or allows you to move those images from on-premises into the cloud, into another provider, as you wish. You can back them up on on-premises because they're fully accessible to you, unlike other cloud providers that have Roach Motel-style VHD storage. This is using our Windows Azure storage that I talked about. So what you can do is download. I just got to, the marketing people spent so much time on this animation, I'd feel bad if I didn't play through them for you. And so that's very exciting. There, no lock-in is the bottom line. So let's go take a look at that no lock-in, because that Linux VM there is sitting with its disks in Windows Azure Storage, and I can see that if I go to the dashboard, right there, there's a VHD sitting right there, and that account is portal VHD something KTZX88. So if I go over to Windows Azure Storage, there it is, and I can say manage keys, so I can copy this into this little tool and say account, new, Windows Azure account, and then go back into the portal and copy the key, and say okay, and now there's VHDs, and one of those is the SharePoint VHDs that I just created. This one right here, actually. So you can see how this is very portable, and I can do actually a copy operation. So I can say copy or download. Now, unfortunately, I can't actually download it because I don't probably have enough disk space locally to do that, but I can copy that into another. If I create another container here, I'd be able to copy that as well. And actually, I just made a copy of it right there instantly, because that's copy on write. So I'll talk more about those ability later, but then also, because this is cloud storage, just simple Windows Azure storage, I can use tools like that. I also get the benefits of cloud storage's high availability. Every copy of every piece of data in tables, queues, and blobs is replicated at least 3 times across 3 servers. So if we have a server failure, we do that same kind of automatic transparent healing behind the scenes. And we also, unless you opt out of it, you get continuous storage geo-replication for blob storage across regions. So if there was a problem in one region, we've got the data within roughly 5 to 15 minute latency over in another data center as well. And we're going to be expanding capabilities for you to be able to have read access to the secondaries as well as control failover yourself shortly. So we get all that for free just because we built on top of that foundation. Let's talk about cache now. So we introduced dedicated cache feature this past summer as well. What this lets you do is create a cache for your application, whether it's the Branding Police application, if it wanted to cache accesses to the database or any other data. This makes it really easy to drop caching capability right into your application so that its cache is now using memory of your worker roles or web roles. Further, you can also, if you want, have a dedicated caching tier. And it's really simple to drop one of those into a cloud service where it will have its own virtual machines with the distributed cache across those virtual machines. And so your app just calls the caching APIs. It's going to go out and talk to those virtual machines and get high availability support. Lots of people use Memcached to talk to their caches. That's the way that protocol that they like. And so we've got compatibility with Memcached's protocol, so it's easy to drop this into those kinds of applications as well. And I'm going to demonstrate that caching really quickly here with a simple little application. This is let me close all these and create a new one. It's a little simple Twitter app. It just pulls from a Twitter feed. And where's Twitter Reader? It's fallen off my recents, so let me go find it. And here it is. Now, Twitter Reader pulls from a Twitter feed, and that's, you'll see, will take a few seconds if I don't have caching on every time I hit the application. So let me find Twitter feed or controller here. This is the heart of the application, get tweets, which you can see when I don't have caching turned on, simply goes right to the Twitter feed and pulls tweets that match a certain name that is specified in the application. So let's run this and see how it behaves without a cache, where it goes to talk to Twitter to pull the feed. I think Visual Studio is trying to get my attention someplace here. So this is going to get Twitter, Windows Azure tweets from Twitter. And right here, it prints out how long it took. So this took 1.6 seconds. If I do a refresh, 1.5 seconds. And that's because there's no caching. Every time it's going right out to Twitter and pulling that full stream of tweets. If I go into the roles configuration, the same way that we were looking at it before for Branding Police, there's a caching tab down here. And I can say that I want caching enabled just by clicking that button. And then I get 2 options. I can say co-located in the role and use up to this amount of RAM in that role, because my website's going to be running in that role. I don't want it to consume all of the RAM, so I'm going to adjust it accordingly. And once I've done that, and I add, which I already have, the caching assembly via NuGet, I can go back into the Twitter Reader controller, and I can define cache. Oops, change it, what? Changes to 64. Oh, it's because I'm, yeah, still running it. So I define cache, and what that does is create a new data cache. It's going to pull all the tweets and dump them right into the cache. Now, this is a very simple toy application. It doesn't actually go and check to see if there's updates, and it's just going to drop in. Basically, once it's in the cache, it's going to pull from the cache. But let's see how fast it is pulling from the cache, just to show you how quick and easy it is to add caching capability. So same thing. And the first time, of course, it's going to take roughly the second and a half to go pull the Twitter feed. And the second time is when the cache kicks in. So 2.6 seconds, 44 milliseconds, 1.6. And you can see now we're seeing the benefits of caching. So that's the caching in action. And one of the aspects of caching, which you kind of saw, is that is this pattern right here, where I have a web role and I can scale it out, and my cache scales out with it, and it becomes not just a single VM cache, which is what you get with ASP.NET caching, but it becomes a distributed cache so that all of the VMs can pull from basically a globally viewed cache, and we get essentially a 1.2 gigabyte cache versus just the 300 gigabytes we might have per VM. You can also, like I said, create this dedicated caching role, which is a worker role running in its own VMs and utilizing all of the RAM of those VMs, whatever size VMs you create. So let's say that we've got a 12, we're using extra large VMs with 14 gig of RAM, and we set the cache size to 12 gig, and we create two instances. Now we've got a 24 gigabyte distributed cache. The latency from going from the middle, from the front end to this cache, it's about one millisecond round trip. So if you're caching something expensive, like going off to some internet feed or a database that's going to potentially give you some lag, this cache will make it very improve your performance, and you can scale it out the same ways that I showed you scaling out. So that's a look at caching. Let's talk about Service Bus now. The queuing facility that I showed you in Branding Police, built on top of Windows Azure Storage, is fairly primitive. It lets you drop messages in a queue. It's got this nice capability for fault tolerance, where a message, if it's in the queue, somebody picks it up out of the queue. Until they delete it from the queue, it's invisible. And what that allows, with a timeout on it, and what that allows is if the back end fails processing the message will reappear in the queue, and then another back end will see it and pick it up. That's how you get the high availability. But we've got a more advanced queuing facilities we call Service Bus. Service Bus gives you capabilities like Relay, and it's really better set up for alternate identity authentication, so you can authenticate using Windows Azure Active Directory principles or other principles. So you can use it as a queuing mechanism to go from on-premise to the cloud, or even from on-premise to on-premise, from mobile device to mobile device. And you can also publish data contracts using WCF services so that you can provide a secure front end to a back end database that might be on premises and only allow out the data that you want to allow out without having to make the whole database available to anybody coming and hitting the front end. I've talked a little bit about the benefits of being loosely coupled, and this is a cloud design pattern. When I talked about Branding Police, these are some animations that just show you when you're tightly coupled and you've got a front end talking to a particular back end, and that back end's talking to another service, and there's a failure, that failure propagates all the way back out. But when you're loosely coupled with the queues, then what happens is the front end just drops orders in the queue. If the back end fails, a new back end can spin up, pull the item from the queue, like I mentioned, and the failure is completely invisible to the outside world. What they'll see is additional latency. They might have to press F5, but other than that, it's completely invisible. And in fact, if it's well designed and the front end didn't die, then F5 is not even necessary. So that's the benefits of front ends. Plus, it automatically supports scaling. So you don't have to have your front ends even know how many back ends there are. It just drops into the queue, and the back ends, there's more items going to the queue, spin up more back ends to go process those items. No coordination with the front ends. So those are the benefits of loosely coupled architecture. Now let's take a look at service bus queues in action. And this is a kind of fun little demo because you can participate. I'm still getting used to that whole start screen thing, as you can see. But what I've got is a little app, service bus queue. And there's a queue sender, which is a cloud application. And if we go look at it, basically all it's going to do is there's a little ASP.NET front end that when you enter a message, drops it in a queue called orders and sends it. That's as simple as that app is. Just take whatever the user enters on a form and drop it in a queue. Let's go take a look at the back end. I've already deployed that front end up into Azure, so we can go look at it in a second. But then I've got a little console application. All it does is sits and waits for messages to come out of the queue. So here it's going to go and connect to that orders queue, sit and wait for messages from it. If a message is not null, it's going to dump it out to standard out. So let's get launched that thing. Well, actually, let's wait, because I'll show you how messages can build up in the queue. So if I go to my cloud services here, and I go to the queuing app, go to the dashboard. Wait, oh, I'm in the wrong thing. Cloud services. And let me copy that URL so that, in case you didn't see it. There's service bus, MR service bus queue cloudapp.net. And once you're there, you can send me a message. So I'll put one in. And what that's doing, like I said, is just dropping things in the queue. Let's go run the on-premises app now. Drag this over to the side. And, all right, Corey, I know that's you. Monkeys. Bananas. It's a very great sessions, thanks. Is it Azure for Windows or Windows Azure? That's very funny. Sup. That was also Corey. Oh. All right, looks like we've got a very interactive audience today. I was actually expecting that to be a little more fun than it was, but Corey, thanks. Now, the other aspect of queue, the other feature of queues, is something we call service bus relay. Like I mentioned, that lets you have WCF contracts published out to the web so that your client application, talking WCF, is ending up talking through our service bus relay service synchronously to an application that is sitting on the server side of that WCF contract. And I've got a very toy, kind of a toy app to demonstrate that. And that is this app right here, which is consists of both a client and a server. And so there's the cloud version, which is the client side. Let me look at the on-premise version. Now, the on-premise version, the idea behind this toy app is that there's a database on-premise, and I want to have the cloud app only access certain kinds of information in that database, specifically in this, what I've constructed so far, just the customer database, just the customer table in that database. And so I've created a WCF contract here, which has a get customers interface on it. And that will go and query the database for the customer list and send that back to the client. On the server side, if we go take a look at that, it's just a simple application that calls that interface when somebody clicks on UX. So it's right here in Home Controller, of course. Sorry, customer controller. And if I say index, this is going to call that get customers WCF method. And that will go through service bus because of the connection that I've set up and talk to the service bus on premises. Now, to be honest with you, I'd never set up a WCF contract before like this, and certainly not through Service Bus Relay, and it literally only took me about 3 weeks to do it. No, I'm just kidding. It didn't take me that long. It only took me a couple hours to figure the whole thing out from start to finish, and part of it was just, okay, get this connection string here, put it in a, you know, app config, and wire things up that way. It was mostly just plumbing the thing together, not writing any serious amount of code. As you can see, this thing is almost no code. So I've got that application up and running in the cloud. Let me fire up the on-premise version so that it can sit. And what this is going to do is just simply spit out, get that it is getting that method call every time it gets hit from the front end. And here's the front end service, and here's the relay app. And this is the only thing I've implemented. If I press that, it's going to report the results of what I've got in my local SQL Server Express database, and I've put two customers in there. And if I look at the app itself, it just says that it got one. It got a request, and if I do that again, you can see that it got another request. So that's going through that cloud service relay. Really powerful way to connect. And now that database is securely, it's behind my firewall on my local laptop. Only that customer database, those customer rows are let out that particular data. And the client is also authenticated using the service bus authentication. So a couple of last things before we wrap up. You saw when I created mobile service that I got a database created for me. And database is a separate cloud service, middleware service that we've got up in Windows Azure. How many people have asked your IT department to create a database ever before for you? And how long does that take you? This long? That's long. Longer than I can reach? That's pretty long. 2 weeks? 3 weeks? 6 months? Long time. Well, how fast is building deploying a database up in Windows Azure? Let's take a look at that. By going over to the database tab, you can see I already have my bananas database that was created for me before, but I can say new data services SQL database, do a quick create. We'll call this one, I'm not even going to bother asking anymore. All right, gorilla. Let's see if we got, yeah. And we're taking all the animals. And I can actually deploy it in an existing existing server. So there's this concept of servers and databases. I could create a new server like you saw me create before. But creating a database, boom, it's there. Done. Got my database. And again, same monitoring views. I see deadlocks, failed connections, successful connections, statistics for the database. I can get the connection string. I can, if I want to, go and configure this database and scale it out, just the same way that I've talked about everything else. This is 1 gig, which is web, which costs, I don't know, it's like $10 a month, and I can scale it out, or it's actually less than that. I can't remember what the cost is. But business-wise, if I want bigger, I can go up to 150, and if I say save, I will literally, in a few seconds, scale my database from that free 1 gig tier up to 150 gig. Size database, and it's done. So I've just created my 150 gigabyte database. I can also do things like export the contents of the database into cloud storage, into blob storage, and then I can download it on premise. So this is a way to do backups. I can also do imports the same way from cloud storage up into Windows Azure and the SQL Azure database. I see people streaming in. I think they're a little late, but welcome, everybody. You're here for the last feature that I'm going to show you, which we literally announced about a week and a half ago, and that is our marketplace. And our marketplace, I need to log out and log back in with a different identity because Microsoft people can't use the marketplace. So I've got to trick it and use my Hotmail account. So let me go back in and use And now when I've, this will show you how easy it is for third parties or even you to plug in and sell your services through Windows Azure through this marketplace capability. Once this comes up, I'm going to go down to the marketplace selection, and I'm going to, here it comes coming up. It's called add-ons. And I've actually already created one called Mongo Labs, but let me go create a new one for you so you can see just how easy it is. Let's say that I want store. You can see here's all of them. There's things like AppDynamics, Aspera Server On Demand, ClearDB we've got in there, MongoDB, we've got New Relic, we've got SendGrid here so you can send email from Windows Azure using through them. I'm going to go and create MongoDB, another one here. And there's a free offer here that I can take advantage of, which I can then upload. Now I've already created one called MongoLab, so let's call it MongoLab 12. And what this will do is create a Mongo NoSQL database for me. I will be able to get the connection string out of it. This literally takes just a few seconds. And then once I've got that connection string, I can plug that into my application that talks NoSQL, MongoDB, and drop stuff into that database. And there, I didn't realize you had to purchase free stuff, but apparently you do. And it's purchasing Mongo. You can see it's creating. And I won't bother, because I'm just about out of time, showing you the little applet. But the other benefit you get here is you get, here's the connection string information, the way you get that. You just copy and paste that into your application. And you can go right to Mongo's website. It'll auto-log in, single sign-on, in there using your credentials that you've logged into Windows Azure with, and now you can manage that database, and you can see I added into the existing Mongo database entry called Friends, and this being NoSQL, there's what I added in my little app. If I'd run it for you, it just drops in a couple of attributes there and drops it right in the database, and then I can go and manage it right through using Mongo Database's native management. So that's just an example of the marketplace. So that brings me to the billing. If you do purchase, the bill comes for those services right on your Windows Azure bill, so you're not having to go deal with paying MongoDB, getting a separate bill from them and one from us. So last thing I wanted to just highlight is the fact that we support a whole bunch of different programming languages. I focus mostly on C# here, of course, but you can see that we've got Node.js, Java, PHP, Python, and then random collection of other languages that we've got first-class support in terms of client-side libraries, in terms of server-side libraries as well for your applications. That we, all of those runtimes that I just showed you on that list are open source, so you can go look at the source code to all of them. This is our new commitment to open source, so all of the libraries, assemblies that are associated with Windows Azure programming, you can go look at, get copies of them, modify them, fix our bugs for us. Please tell us about those bugs. But all of that is there. So if you then build your own functionality on top, if you just want to see, well, how are they doing it? How are they talking to Windows Azure Tables? Because that's something I'd like to do myself in a different language or environment, you can go look at what we've done. The